Thank you. Thank you very much, Lara. Thank you, Minister. Ranveig, perhaps you could press the button for a film. We made four or five films promote the World Report on Disability. Each was with a woman from a different culture facing different barriers. And we decided to show you the one featuring the woman from the UK. Her name is Rachel. She was in fact, Newcastle, where I come from. And she was wanting to be a nurse. And she was facing barriers in education, and she was facing barriers in employment. So I want you to watch this. It's only two or three minutes to show a different culture.
I've wanted to be a nurse since I was about six. I spent a lot of time in hospital myself as a child, and I was on dialysis for 4 years, and then I had a life-saving kidney transplant when I was seven. And I think the doctors and nurses, when I was younger, just made such a difference to me. And they were like a second family to me, really. And I wanted to make that same difference to someone else. I think the main obstacles for me were people's attitudes and people's perceptions. And a lot of people, you know, when I tried to get into university and when I applied for jobs, they struggled to see past the disability. People just assumed because I had a disability that I couldn't perform even the simplest of tasks, even as much as operating a fire extinguisher. Getting into nurse training was particularly difficult for me. I mean, like, I went to careers advisors and they'd just look at me and say, why don't you apply for a desk job? And I'd say, well, I don't want to apply for a desk job. And then even when I did actually get interviews for university courses, the interviewer would just look at me before I'd even sat down and she'd say, I don't know if this course is physically suitable for you, yet she didn't even know anything about me. I think the main reason I was treated differently since I set out to become a nurse was probably because people were scared, because they've never been faced with anyone like me before. I was made to feel like a liability, really, because of the way I look. And one of the things they made me do was carry out risk assessments, which no one else had to do. And this involved just having loads of people stand around watching me whilst I completed basic nursing tasks such as holding a baby or pushing a wheelchair. I think having a disability has actually made me a better nurse. I can fully empathise with the patients in my care because I've had similar experiences myself, so I know what they're going through. The ward I work on now is a renal ward, which is an excellent grounding for the future for me, but I know that I still have a lot to learn as I'm only newly qualified. This is disability to me. What's it to you?
And if we could go back to the PowerPoint, that's great. The music for that film is an Aboriginal musician called Jeffrey Yunupingu Gurumal, who himself is also disabled. He's a blind singer. So what we were trying to do with that slogan, "What's disability to this is disability to me, what's it to you," is to challenge people to look beyond the disability. I want to show you the first slide. It's also a picture of a disabled woman. This is a year ago, a little bit more than a year ago, in Tahrir Square in Cairo. And the reason that I wanted to put this picture in is because, you know, you may have probably seen on the television the pictures of the Arab Spring. I don't think you probably saw pictures of disabled people there, but they were there. When I was in Cairo last year, I met disability activists who are also democracy activists in Egypt. And I think what this image does is to challenge our images, our thinking about what disability is and what disabled people can do. In the same way that the Arab Spring challenged our ideas of what the Islamic world was like and what Arabs could do and would want. And I think the point is that people in Egypt and Libya and Tunisia want the same things as everybody else. They want democracy and control over their lives. And it's the same for disabled people. They want fundamentally the same as everybody else, democracy and control over their lives. And so the Arab Spring, for me, is a sort of metaphor for the change that we are trying to achieve in the world and also in Iceland, to challenge to our ways of thinking about disability and disabled people. That's the transformation that we're trying to achieve. And it was very wonderful to hear from the minister about the process of ratifying the Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities. That gives us an opportunity in Iceland, just as this world report gives us a global opportunity to think about disability and to change the ways that we consider and respond to disabled people. So what's the background? This is a World Health Organization report. We are a democratic body as far as we possibly can be. We have a World Health Assembly, of which all our 193 member states take part, including Iceland. And the Assembly tells us what to do, like the General Assembly of the United Nations. And they told us to prepare this report. Now, you know that the WHO is about health, and disability is far more than a health issue, which is why the World Bank came on board. The World Bank fund infrastructure development, school building, employment projects. And so they were able to, as it were, speak to the other areas of the report that go beyond health. The context, as the minister reminds us, is the Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities. And the convention is our moral compass. It tells us what we're aiming at and for in Iceland and in all the other countries, the 151 countries that have signed the report, the convention. But it's all very well knowing where you're going. We need to know how to get there. And the World Report provides the best available evidence about the lives of disabled people and the barriers they face. Because, as our minister would tell you, governments depend on evidence. They can't make decisions on the basis of good opinions or anecdotes. They have to know that what they're doing will work, is cost-effective, is the best solution. And this is what the World Report tries to do. It tries to give the evidence to support the convention so that we can make change in the lives of people with disabilities. Finally, the ICF, the International Classification of Functioning. This is WHO's way of understanding the interaction that the minister referred to between people who have health conditions and the wider society. And it's important because the World Health Organization used to be seen as the problem. We were the medical model of disability. But the ICF says no. The environment is so important in defining and shaping the lives of disabled people. And as Laura said, by environment we mean the attitudes, the policies, the physical barriers, the services. That's what matters. And that's what the ICF also says. And the other point about the ICF that I want to mention is that it refers to everybody. The ICF is not about a narrow group of people with problems. It's about human beings. We all have functioning possibilities. We all have functioning limitations. We can't all do everything. Sometimes we are injured. We will all age. I was saying to Ranveig yesterday, where are we going forward with disability? And for me, one of the ways we go forward with disability is about aging. We live in aging societies. I'll say a bit more about that in a minute. So what do we want to find out? We want to help governments. We want to recommend action. I would have liked to have shown you another film by this woman, with this woman, Faustina. Faustina Urasa comes from Tanzania. And she made a film for us about wheelchair provision. Now, why would we bother making a film about wheelchair provision? All of these disabled people in the room who need them have wheelchairs? Not in Africa. Globally, only 5 to 15% of people have the wheelchairs that they need. Everybody else is struggling with no wheelchair or inadequate wheelchair provision. And Faustina came to the launch in New York. She spoke beautifully. And she said, this report mustn't sit on the shelf. Now, I'm an academic. Ranveig's an academic. And some of you who are not academics think, they're just writing another book to sit on the shelf. This is not the case with this report. This report is about making a difference. It's about guiding action and to support implementation of the convention. So how did we do it? Well, it's wonderful to see at least 200 people here today, because this is how we did it. We brought together lots of people. And there are people here with disabilities. There are people here who are academics. There are people here who are political representatives. There are people here from parent organizations. There are people here who are from medical backgrounds, researchers, the fundamentally disabled people themselves. That's the coalition that we brought together to write this report. 370 different people from 70 different countries gave their stories, commented, edited, wrote, reviewed, came to our four consultation meetings in Costa Rica, Tanzania, Manila, and Rome. And we had these consultations and peer review. And it was fundamentally important to ensure that disabled people's organizations were involved. And when we launched in New York on the 9th of June last year, Diane Richler, who's the chair of the International Disability Alliance, endorsed the report. Now, maybe that seems not very significant to you. To us, it was the... I had tears in my eyes. Because if the disability movement did not accept this report, all our efforts were wasted. We needed them to endorse the report. We needed them to say, not that they agreed with every single word, but that overall it was a good report. They could support it. Because what we need in the countries where we launched the report, and we're going to launch in 100 countries worldwide, at least. We need the government to know that the movement are on the side of the report, and this is the way to go. We need to speak with one voice, even though we have diverse experiences and perspectives. And so it was wonderful that the movement supported it. We want to take people along with us. Disability is a very complex issue. And if we don't work together, we won't get anywhere. And I don't know about the politics of government in Iceland, but I was very excited to know that the new ministry is both health and social welfare. Too often, these ministries are separate. They don't talk to each other. So I hope that you're all talking to each other inside the ministry. Right. Just as we're talking, hopefully, to Ministry of Education and to the ministry responsible for transport and the ministry responsible for employment, because it's a cross-government issue. So what are the headlines from the World Report? The first is how many disabled people there are in the world. For a long time, the WHO said 10%. 10% of the population were disabled. And maybe you're familiar with that figure. Where did it come from? Nobody really knows. In the 1970s, somebody said it. I think there is an envelope in the archives of the WHO. And on the back of the envelope, somebody's gone, 10%? ? Because there's no evidence for 10%. What we did, though, is we went out and we got good data. We basically used the World Health Survey of 50 different countries. We asked questions about people's functioning. We put the answers, as it were, on a continuum, because disability is on a continuum. And we decided where to make a cutoff point. And we made the cutoff point in terms of what people with what everybody agreed to be disabilities scored. People with paraplegia, people with blindness, people with depression, people with diabetes, they scored about 40. So we took 40 as our cutoff point, and that created 15% of the population. 1 billion people worldwide, 1 billion people, more than was thought. Now, in Iceland, you won't be surprised. You've got pretty good data. You think, well, yes, that's about right, maybe a bit higher. But globally, this is much higher than people thought. In low-income countries, I'll tell you how they count disability. They look around and they go house to house and they go, have you got any blind people? Have you got any deaf people? Have you got any people with intellectual disability? Have you got any people with mental health problem? Have you got any people with physical mobility problem? Yes? No. And if you do that, what we call a headcount method, you miss out loads of people who are not in those categories, who don't define as disabled, but who have functioning issues. So that's why it's important to have a better approach and you get a much bigger figure. Now, when governments hear 15% of the population disabled, they get a bit anxious. They go, oh my God, that's 15% of people wanting a pension? That's 15% of the people wanting those very expensive services. What are we going to do? Now, so this is why I need to remind the minister. We're talking about people who have rights, people who face discrimination, people who need access. We're not talking about people with big needs for services. That's a much smaller figure. So we thought about 110 to 190 million adults have very complex disability and will need that intensive investment. That's 2 to 4% of the population, much smaller number. So we can breathe a sigh of relief. We need to make the world accessible for everybody, but we need to target our investment of intensive support on a much smaller number of people. Now, I said I'd come back to the aging issue. And that's because this number is not going smaller. It's increasing. It's increasing because we live in aging societies. That's wonderful news. We're living longer. That's fantastic. But older people are more likely to have difficulties in functioning. Half of all people over 60 are disabled. So I think this is very important for what we have a window when we can build more inclusive societies. Because if you have more accessible societies, people are more independent, but also they require less support. They can participate. If the environment is accessible, if they have the assistive technology they need, they can live in their own home for longer. They don't need intensive cost support. So we have a window to make our societies more inclusive and accessible before we suddenly have a lot more older people. Because we will have more older people and the numbers will increase. And so I know there are medical people in this room and I welcome you. And sometimes people think the medicine is going to eliminate disability. It's not. It can make our lives better in many, many ways, but it's not going to eliminate disability. I'll give you a few reasons why not. Premature newborns. Healthcare and medicine can save the lives of premature newborns. That's wonderful. But you know that half of all premature newborns have disabilities. People with HIV. Antiretrovirals can stop people dying of HIV. Wonderful. But they're living with a depressed functioning because of the disease. And again, people who have road traffic injuries. They're not going to die now, hopefully. They're going to live, but they're going to live with disability. So in technical terms, what we're doing is we're reducing mortality. That's great. But we're increasing morbidity. Less people dying, more people living, more disabled people. Thanks to medicine. So that's great. Disability, the doctors are creating more disabled people. When I tell that to doctors, they get a bit depressed. But it's wonderful. Because we want to live. We don't want to die. So, more people, and particularly the rise in chronic diseases, diabetes, heart disease, arthritis, cancer. You know, a lot of this is the huge global increase, which we need to understand and deal with, and this is a disability issue. I wanted to also point out that disability disproportionately affects the most vulnerable in our societies. Women, older people, poorer people are more likely to be disabled. And when people are disabled, they're not all equal. Some people are more excluded than others. For example, in schools, we find that people who are blind or deaf are more excluded. In the workforce, in employment, we find that people with intellectual disability or people with mental health issues are more excluded. So we need to attend to the differences between disabled people. So now you've seen Rachel at the bottom. That's Faustina. She's saying, what's disability to you? That's Mia on the right-hand side. She's a woman with intellectual disability from Lebanon. And she talked to us about being excluded from school and how she just wanted an education. And I put those pictures on that slide because all of these women are talking about the barriers they face. We also have a film, you can see it on the WHO YouTube website, of a woman from Bolivia who is talking about physical access barriers. She campaigned in her city to have ramps at the intersections, you know, curb cuts, so that wheelchair users could cross the road. Anyway, what are the problems people face? I know this won't be surprising to you. Anybody who knows anything about disability knows these problems. But lack of policies. For example, a policy on rehabilitation. Many, many countries just don't have that. Access standards to say what access means. They don't have that. So a lack of standards and policies, negative attitudes, we know this is a common problem. Lack of services, particularly in low, middle-income countries. Just one statistic, if you will. Rehabilitation doctors. I don't know how many rehabilitation doctors there are in Iceland. I think a couple, I should imagine. Don't know. Maybe somebody's here, tell me later. There's 300 and something thousand people in Iceland. In sub-Saharan Africa, there's nearly 800 million people. They have 6 rehabilitation doctors. 6 for 800 million people. Inadequate funding, lack of accessibility, lack of involvement, and finally, lack of data and research. It's so nice to be sitting next to my friend Ranveig, because I know that disability studies is developing in Iceland in very strong ways, and I recognize faces of people around this room who are doing really good research. That's fantastic. We need this in every country. We need to know what the lives of disabled people are like. So as a result, poorer health, lower educational achievements, and of course, if you don't do well in school, you don't get a job. If you don't get a job, you end up poor. If you can't participate, your family members have to look after you, support you. They can't work. The whole household ends up poor. People have restricted lives. They die younger. The life expectancy of somebody with spinal cord injury. I became spinal cord injured in August 2008. I'm going to live till I'm 70 or older. If I'd been spinal cord injured in Sierra Leone or Cameroon or any of these countries, I would be dead. Because the life expectancy of somebody's spinal cord injury is 1 to 2 years. Disabilities that we consider to be problems but not terminal are terminal conditions in many, many countries of the world. And this is not rocket science. It's not because I have had high-tech medicine. People die of bladder infections, pressure sores. They die within 1 to 2 years. And this was exactly what used to happen in our countries. After the Second World War, the life expectancy of somebody with spinal cord injury was 2 years. But we have nursing care. We have health care. We have better wheelchairs. We have better catheters. And people don't have to die. And that's what we want for all the countries of the world. So it's the way society treats people with disabilities that matters most. We know this is the case. Of course, people have limitations of their body or mind as a result of their health condition. But we put a burden, an extra burden on top of that by making life more difficult than it need be. So the chapters of the World Report, the first one gives the overview of how to understand disability. Then we have all the data in chapter 2, lots of tables and maths for those that like that sort of thing. We talk about the healthcare issues in the third chapter. Rehabilitation, assistance and support, community living and independent living and so forth. But also support for families with disabled children. Enabling environments, that's mainly buildings and roads and transport, and also information and communication. We live in an information era. If people can't access information through the internet, they're really disadvantaged. Education, work and employment, and then we bring together the recommendations. So I'm just going to spend a few minutes on each chapter. I don't want to go into detail. Please download the report. We also have some memory sticks which have the report on them. So please get access to the bit of the report that matters most to you. So data. I talked about counting disability. And the thing is, that what do we do when we count disability? It's not just about people with physical or mental issues. It's also about barriers in society. How many sign language interpreters are there? What is wheelchair provision like? How many schools are accessible? That we need data on those things, not just data about people with disabilities and their individual problems. And we need data to be comparable. That's why we should use the definitions in the ICF. We should use similar methodologies. And then we'd be able to tell. I was at Ranveig's house yesterday. There was a very interesting PhD comparing employment policies between Denmark and Sweden. Now, I'm naive. I can't tell the difference between Danes and Swedes. You can, but I can't. But there's a big difference in employment. Not in the overall employment, but in the employment of people with more complex disability. And you're twice as likely to be employed if you've got a complex disability in Sweden than you are in Denmark. Now, I had no idea about that. But this colleague, I think, of Ranveig, did the research, found out why. And it's because employers have responsibilities towards their people with disabilities in Sweden. They can't just get rid of them. They have to not just make a level playing field, they have to do more. They have to find them work and find them the solutions. So, bingo, you get twice as many people remaining employed, which is what we want. But you can't find that out unless you can compare, unless you have the same definition of disability. Then you can see two very similar countries with different outcomes. There's no point in comparing Denmark with Vietnam. Of course they'll be different. But you compare Denmark with Sweden, or you compare Vietnam to Cambodia, then you can see where their difference is. And that must surely tell us we can do something. There are other ways, I'm sure, where Denmark's better than Sweden. But in employment, if I was the Danish employment minister, I'd be saying, we need to learn from the Swedes. Do you think? I'm not sure whether that'll happen, but it's worth a try. I'm going to Denmark in May. I'll try. I'll tell you what happens. So turning to healthcare. Now, I said that disability was not a health issue. We don't want to be defined in terms of what's wrong with us. But people with disabilities have health needs. They have health needs just like everybody else. And in fact, often people with disabilities have a narrower margin of health. I told you about the pressure sores and the urinary tract infections for somebody who uses a wheelchair. What we need is access to mainstream healthcare. It's not a matter of more specialists. It's about a matter of using the same healthcare as everybody else. But the trouble is there are huge barriers. So there's a problem that when a disabled person goes to a doctor, they only see the disability. They don't see their normal needs. Now, when a woman with disability goes to the doctor, she might need a cervical smear. She might need a mammogram. She might have other issues. She might need a flu shot. I don't know. It's not all about the fact that she's got multiple sclerosis or wheelchair user or intellectual disability. I've told you about the narrower margin of health. I think some disabled people have particular health risks. I mean, people with intellectual disability, for example, often are overweight. They don't need to be, but if they're overweight, that's going to bring with it health risks. People with mental health issues smoke much more. It's sort of self-medication sometimes, but that brings risks. So we need to be aware of, we need to be understanding of disabled people's health. Not blame everything on the impairment. Make sure people get general health needs covered, but also be aware of any specific vulnerabilities they may have and ensure you meet those needs. For example, we just published a systematic review of violence against disabled people in The Lancet. And we found disabled people had a 50% higher chance of experiencing violence than non-disabled people. People with mental health problems were nearly four times as likely to experience violence as non-disabled people. We now have a systematic review of violence against children with disabilities. We've just submitted it to The Lancet. It'll be coming out soon, we hope. What does it say? Children with disabilities are three times as likely to suffer violence and abuse as non-disabled children. So these are particular vulnerabilities that we need to be aware of, to respond to challenge, to stop, and to support victims. So, and injuries. I mean, how many people in wheelchairs have injuries? Loads. I'm talking about falling out of the chair. I'm talking about being hit by cars because you're slowed across the road. There's lots of now evidence coming through about the greater vulnerability to injuries of people with disabilities. But what do we find in terms of healthcare? And this is global. People with disabilities are twice as likely to find healthcare provider skills or equipment inadequate to meet their needs. They're three times as likely to be denied care and four times as likely to be treated badly in healthcare. So the people who need this healthcare the most are getting the worst service. This is a global story. So we need to do something about that. The catastrophic health expenditure, I guess that's not so relevant in Iceland because you have a good social health insurance. But most of the world does not have that. And so catastrophic health expenditure refers to health costs that push you into poverty. And disabled people are 50% more likely to have catastrophic health expenditure than non-disabled people. I guess the closest that might come to you is if you go to the United States and you get injured. Then you'll know what catastrophic health expenditure is like if you're not properly insured. A friend of a friend of mine had that. She was a dancer. She went to perform in the United States. She broke her back. It bankrupted her family. They had to sell their house. They had an appeal on the internet. Literally, that's what we call catastrophic health expenditure. Now, you don't have to go to the United States. You can go to Malawi or you can go to Sierra Leone and see catastrophic health expenditure. So what do we do about it? We try and extend health insurance. We try to provide reasonable accommodation in medical settings. We try to train doctors and nurses and midwives to include people with disabilities. We use innovative ways to communicate information. We have maybe specific well-person clinics targeted at people with intellectual disability. This really works. Because if you just think of people with intellectual disability coming to the normal doctor's surgery, that won't happen. But what if you say, look, we're having a special session for people with intellectual disability on Tuesday afternoon, first Tuesday of the month, then maybe people come and they have the health check. Because we should care about the health of people with intellectual disability. We should make sure that they get screened too, that they have a good diet too, that they take physical activity too. Because everything that we care about our own health, people with intellectual disability also should care. In low-income countries, community-based rehabilitation. This is a way of reaching poor and remote communities and promoting access to the mainstream. And we need better research. Too often, when people are doing health research, they exclude disability. They say, oh, well, that's what we call it. It's a confounder. A confounder means a detail that confuses it. In the old days, they thought being a woman was a confounder. So the research was only on men. It's true. It's daft. Now they don't do that so much. But they do exclude disabled people. And maybe sometimes that's necessary, but mostly it's not. We need disabled people researched in healthcare. And we need disaggregated data to see how disabled people are doing. There's a really interesting study in the UK, a formal inquiry into inequalities in health. And they looked at the patient records, and they did lots of research, and they found that people with intellectual disability and people with mental health problems were having more diseases, were dying younger, were worse served by the health care because they disaggregated the data, and suddenly they saw these problems. And that was Britain, which is a high-income country with a very good health service, but still these groups were really poorly served. So rehabilitation. Now, disabled people often don't like to talk about rehabilitation. It's a period of their life which was perhaps traumatic and hard and difficult, learning to walk or to talk or to look after themselves again after an injury or a stroke or blindness or whatever. It's a traumatic period, but it's so important because rehabilitation or habilitation for children with disability enables people to maximize their functioning, enables people to become independent. It's a gateway to school, to work, to living independently. It's not glamorous, but it's a right. Article 26 of the Convention talks about the right to rehabilitation. And that includes the right to wheelchairs, to the assistive technology that people need. Without it, you cannot function effectively. So we can't ignore this area. It's a good investment. It builds capacity and functioning. It reduces dependency. And there's a real problem that we don't have enough rehab personnel. I told you that figure about rehabilitation doctors in sub-Saharan Africa. Well, there's also figures for physiotherapists, occupational therapists, speech and language therapists. Now, many of you or your children have had access to these therapies. Good. You know how important they are. But they're not there in Asia, Africa, South America. You might have a country and it's got one occupational therapist in the whole country. How can you reach and help people to become independent? And you want rehabilitation not stuck in one central hospital where all the experts are, but into the community. Now, one of the problems that we find is that in medicine and in rehab, you train up people in low-income countries, and then they see that they're going to be paid a lot more in London, and they skip out of the country. There's this drain of wealth of health professionals to high-income countries. It's a rational decision on their part. I'm not blaming them as individuals, but we need to do something about it. We need to retain healthcare personnel where they're needed most. And one of the strategies to do this is to train them to the mid-level. There's this concept called mid-level workers. It's very cruel, really, because what we're saying is we're not going to train people to the extent that they can go and work in Britain. We want them not to be qualified to work in Britain, so they can't leave. We want them to be qualified to work in their own country. Now, you could say that's racist or oppressive or whatever, but it's a cynical strategy to make sure that the people who need OTs, physios, doctors, whatever, have them there, and that they don't all just vote with their feet and go to Germany or England or whatever. So we need legislation and regulation, financing, increased human resource capacity, early intervention for children with disabilities, local manufacturing. I mean, my wheelchair was made in Britain, can't remember where it was made, sorry, I beg your pardon, near London. My wheelchair costs £3,000. It's a titanium wheelchair. It weighs 5 kilos. It's just right. It's fitted for me. You can't afford a £3,000 or even a $5,000 wheelchair in Africa. But that's okay because you can build one that's more suited to the local terrain for $150. I don't know if you know, but in China, they manufacture bicycles very cheaply. In China, you could manufacture a basic wheelchair for $15. At $15, surely all of those people who need wheelchairs in Africa and Asia and South America could have a suitable wheelchair. So we need to look at the market, the manufacturing, and get it right. I haven't got much longer, so I'm going to zip through. Assistance and support. I know this is very relevant in Iceland. We need to enable people to live independently in a community. We need to enable them to be heard, to have choices. I went briefly to a very good conference yesterday looking at how the Swedish models of independent living for people with intellectual disabilities have been applied. We've got too much institutionalization. People with disabilities should live in the community and should receive the support they need in the community. Families with children with disabilities should receive support. And that last point is really important. Do you know what percentage of care needs, support needs in Sweden are met by informal care, by families? Do you know what percentage? 80%. So even in Sweden, which has got very advanced independent living, which we should be looking to and emulating, still the majority of the support needs are given by families. So we've got to support families, we've got to support disabled people to make choices, we've got to have a what I would call a mixed economy of care, different solutions. I don't think one solution fits all. But in every case, we're going to try and maximise the independence and the choices of people with disabilities. There's a lot of unmet need. 20% to 40% of need is unmet in high-income countries. So the solutions... individual budgeting has been tried, supporting independent living, training schemes for sign language interpreters and advocates, which maximises involvement. This is a complex one to get, and we could spend the rest of the day talking about deinstitutionalisation, but it's so important. It's such a basic human right to live in a community and to have your views heard at whatever age you are. We take it for granted. Many disabled people just don't have access to that. And to live in a community, you need to have an environment which supports you, an environment which is accessible. And I talked about the challenge of ageing. I don't know about Iceland, but many countries of the world, there is an access law. It's ignored. Nobody checks up. I was in Turkey, and the ramps were just like this. They were just impossible. This is a beautiful ramp. The hotel person proudly told me this ramp is to code. I can see it. I can push myself up that ramp. But the ones in Turkey, they've been putting ramps everywhere. And they've basically been concreting over the steps. So you've got this 45-degree ramp. And I just look at it and go, that is so dangerous. It's like a take off for the space shuttle. It's not going to... I can't do that. So, you need not just a ramp, but the right ramp. You need not just an accessible toilet, but the space to negotiate the toilet. You need websites that are accessible. You need information that's accessible. We're really proud about the World Report. It's available in Braille. It's available in accessible PDF. It's available in an easy read version for people with intellectual disability. It's available in DAISY talking book format. And it'll soon be available in sign language. So this was really important to us, to try and walk the walk, talk the talk, not just tell people to do it when we weren't doing it ourselves. So you need more compliance. You need to use universal design so that buildings are built so they're accessible to all. I know you know this, and maybe this is not such a problem in Iceland. But I've came across some really interesting data the other day. Because it's very difficult. We always say that the costs of making a building accessible from the start are 1% of the total costs. But there's a good example that I heard about in Durban, South Africa. They were going to build a new conference centre. And they had all the plans and all the costs worked out. And then the disability community say, hang on a minute, we need to make it accessible from the start. And then, oh, okay, well, tell us how to do that. So they took the plans and they took them apart again and they made an accessible conference centre. So they had the original plans and costings, and then they built the accessible one. So it's one of those very rare occasions where you compare the two costs. And the cost of the accessible conference centre, the additional cost, wasn't 1%. It was 0.4%. So to make the whole blooming thing accessible to everybody cost less than 0.5% of the total build costs. And yet, I don't know how much you've travelled, but I've been to India, I've been to Africa, I've stayed in hotels which are as smart as any hotel I've ever been in, which have been inaccessible. So they spent a fortune building this beautiful hotel, and they've not made it accessible from the start. And I think that's a crime. The World Bank invest in a beautiful school. It's not accessible. It's just shocking. If we build it accessible from the start, we don't have the problem that I've heard about in Egypt, of a colleague who was carried up and down stairs every day by her classmates in her wheelchair to the classroom. A colleague, the woman who had went to the bathroom at the beginning of the day and then didn't drink anything all day till the end of the day because there was no accessible toilet. It's just not necessary. It's some of the things which exclude people. So we've got to get it right from the start. And I think involving disabled people and designing, planning is the right way to go. Training engineers. I mean, if any software engineers in the room, well, I bet you didn't have access training in part of your degree. Why not? Why don't we give software designers accessibility training so they build accessible websites? Like we should give architects access training so they build accessible buildings. Like we should give doctors equality training so they treat people with respect. If we can ensure that the people that build our society and deliver our services, understand disability from the start, then we wouldn't be in the mess we're in. So, finally, education. You know about education for all, this movement to ensure primary education for every child in the world. It's Millennium Development Goal number 2. Now, many countries are doing quite well on this. But the sad thing is, even countries that are doing well are not doing well for disabled children. And we're talking about just getting to school. We're not talking about the sort of school you go to at this point. We're just talking about getting through the blooming door of the school. Now, Bolivia, more than 90% of children in Bolivia go to primary school. That's great news. Only 40% of children with disabilities in Bolivia go to school. In Indonesia, I think about 70% of children go to school. That's great. Only 25% of disabled children. And why is this? What are the barriers? The barriers are to do with teachers who don't know how to teach disabled children and who are fearful of having children with disabilities in their class. They're to do with inaccessible schools that I mentioned before. They're to do with transport to school. They're to do with low expectations by families. By children themselves. They're to do with lack of leadership. Often the education of disabled children is not with the education ministry. It's with the Ministry of Social Welfare. Because that's not an educational issue, that's a welfare issue. So children with disabilities either don't go to school or they go to segregated schools where they get worse teaching and they emerge with less qualifications and they're not able to get jobs. Or assessment methods, which are not appropriate for the child with disability. So there are many, many ways that we know work to include disabled children in mainstream schools where they belong, which are not being tried, which are not being implemented, and which are leaving disabled children excluded. So, but there are really good signs of progress. Just want to mention a few of those. In Ethiopia, the Sabeta Training College is training teachers to include children who are deaf and blind and have other disabilities. In Laos, there are model projects. In Vietnam, there are model projects where disabled children are included in schools. And they work. It works fine. Inclusion is not a first world luxury. It's a possibility. In fact, it's a necessity in all countries of the world. Because if you think about it, if you're in a low-income country, how can you possibly afford to build a separate, segregated system of schools? You can't afford it. So the only choice for children with disabilities is the mainstream school. That's the only place they can go. So we need to ensure that they're allowed in, that they can physically access the place, and that when they get there, they can do something meaningful, not sit in a corner. And there are these good signs of hope. In Kenya, the Oriang project, where they're teaching with sign language for deaf children. Really nice model projects. But the problem is, we need to widen those model projects to reach more of the children. Because it can work, but it's just not available for everybody. So we need to provide the additional classroom supports. We need to train people. We need to build teacher capacity. And again, it's very variable between high-income countries. We were hearing the other day, Ranveig and I were at a seminar, hearing about Finland and how wonderful Finland's special education provision is and how they invest more in students that need it more and how a third of children in Finland get special education support. It's not seen as a tiny minority. It's seen as maximising the individual potential of all children. Now, you know, Ranveig's suspicious. She doesn't think the Finns are that good. But we know that globally they're much better than most high-income countries, so let's learn from them. And if they're not exactly good, then we make it better. This is the challenge we face. Not to segregate, not to label, but to include in the mainstream. To give people the same chances. And finally, employment. Now, disabled people in high-income countries are twice as likely to be unemployed as non-disabled people. And that's not because they can't do stuff. It's because they face discrimination. Because they're not sufficiently trained and educated, and I'm talking about vocational training as well. It's because there are barriers in the environment. It's because employers are discriminatory and don't believe in a person that they can do things. You saw that video, you saw that woman who's performing really well as a nurse, but people thought she couldn't do it. They said, be a secretary, don't try and be a nurse. We were talking with students today about the aspirations of disabled people. Now, I think it's entirely realistic for disabled people to aspire to a good job, to aspire to a good career. Everybody has talent and potential, and we need to ensure that the talent and potential of disabled people is not wasted, but is used for the benefit of our society. Because a lot of disabled people think that their future is on the pension, that when they leave school, they're just going to go on the pension. And that thinking means that the number of people on benefits rises to proportions that we can't afford. And this is the crisis in OECD countries, that too many people are on the pension. Now, the answer is not to make their lives miserable by cutting the pension, but to give people access to meaningful employment so that they can be independent. And the employment rates of people with disabilities really vary between countries. And again, when the employment rate is varying between two countries that are fundamentally similar, then we know something's going wrong. We know that the country with a lower employment rate is getting something wrong. So we need to learn about the training, about the ways that benefit systems can be designed to encourage people into work. Tapered, So a lot of people are worried about taking a job. They feel they'll fail. So we need to make it easy for them to take the job, try the job, and know that they can go back if it doesn't work. Because otherwise they're just going to never going to risk it. They're going to stay on benefits for the rest of their life, which is costing everybody and is not giving them the fulfillment that they could have and the contribution they could make. So we need properly designed social protection schemes, remove physical barriers, do something about the transport, make a difference. And I think understanding that people with disabilities can contribute and make a difference is so important. So I'm sorry, I've talked too much. These are the recommendations. I'll just highlight the first three. Access to mainstream services. It's much cheaper. Just make sure disabled people can use what you use, that they can use your buses, they can use your health systems, they can use your schools. It's much cheaper to make sure they can just use the mainstream. Cheaper and more just, more supportive of human rights and inclusion. Secondly, there will always be something specific disabled people need. I talked a lot about rehabilitation. That's a specific need. You've got to meet it. If you don't, people are stuck. You could also talk about independent living schemes and social support, vocational training. You need a specific extra to make sure that disabled people come up to the same level. And the minister talked about the National Plan of Action. That's so important. That the country as a whole uses this opportunity of the World Report and the Convention to revise policies, to look at what's right in a particular country, to look at how to meet those needs, where the gaps are. And that all of the partners, everybody who's here today, works together to contribute to that policy so that it will be endorsed by everybody and will be seen as the way forward. So we think a plan of action is really good. I'm not going to go into all the details, but involving people with disabilities is so important. And Ranveig, don't forget, we need more research. Ranveig, she's a busy woman. So this is how the WHO works. We do the World Report. We launch in different countries. We provide technical support. We're, for example, bringing out a model disability survey. We're bringing out guidelines on rehabilitation. I'm doing some training curricula for healthcare workers. So we're trying to help you, but you're working out what you need to do. We're supporting you. We do it in countries, we roll it out, and we try and improve the provision. So, summary, 1 billion people, the numbers is going up. The barriers that people face can be overcome. There's plenty of examples of good practice, which we put in a World Report. We need to scale up and make that best provision available to everybody. It's a very accessible document. Please download it. There are some memory sticks floating around, but you can download it, and you can even buy copies off the WHO website if you want a hard copy. And this is our contact details, myself, my colleague, and my colleague at the World Bank. So please, it's not another publication that can sit on the shelf. It's a publication, it's a tool which we hope you will use to make the world a better place. Thank you.
Thank you so very much, Tom. It was very exciting too, and it was powerful speech.
Thank you.
And the most exciting thing was probably that you took us around the world. You're not just staying in Iceland, the tiny population here, but we have similarities around the world. It is a world report on disability. And I forgot to tell that Tom is one of the authors, and he works with the WHO from 2008. Mm. And Tom is, of course, coming from England, the UK, but lives in Geneva.
Yeah. But you Vikings have always gone around the world. So.
I was
in Turkey, and there's graffiti by Vikings in the Hagia Sophia Mosque in Turkey, because it's like, you know, Odhi was here.
Well, we have 10 minutes to ask questions or make comments to Tom's speech. And we have this nice person here to...
Do you want to take this one?
About the microphone.
Do you want to take this one?
Sure. No microphone here.
Sorry about this. Anyone wants to comment or admire Tom?
No, please. I prefer the report.
What about Minister? Do you want to ask any questions? You've heard enough? Yes? You have to... Yes? No, the microphone is coming. You have to tell your name and ask the question.
Thank you very much, Tom. I was just wondering, because you know a little bit Iceland, what should we begin? We've been talking a lot of things, we know a lot of these things, but we aren't acting enough to do the things we really need to do, like opening the unemployment market. Maybe we got a little bit down because of the crisis, but we are not doing so much for the disabled. So please, can you help us? Because we have been talking a lot, and we've been talking in groups and having good time and everything, but we are not getting what we want.
It's very difficult for me because I have been to Iceland, but I think you've got a very nice geysir, and I think you've got a very nice waterfall. But I really don't know enough to give you advice, and in a direct sense. But I think that perhaps two things that in any country even after the crisis, you're a high income country. One is inclusive education. Making sure that children are getting to mainstream schools and having good outcomes from mainstream schools. Because for all of us, if we start with good education, we can do everything. I owe my position in life to my education. Mm. And most people in this room have achieved what they have because of their education. So that gives people a chance. So I don't know what the outcome measures are for your schools, but to ensure that all children in Iceland are going to a good school, a mainstream school, and have the potential to learn. And the second thing is, I think, for a high-income country is living independently in the community. Can we make sure that people are out of institutions and living in as situations as near to normal life as we possibly can? That was why it's so exciting to hear about the development of independent living in Iceland and personal assistance. And I know you're doing that, and I hope that it will go well. I'm sure it will go well. I live in Switzerland, as we heard, and Switzerland legalized direct payments for personal assistance on the 1st of January this year. And the Swiss are very cautious people. They had an experiment for 5 years to check that, because they knew that personal assistance had worked in many, many countries, but the Swiss might be different. So they had a little trial, and you know what? The Swiss aren't that different. It works in Switzerland. And then they were worried, what about the money and what about the law? And what? So they had seven research projects on the different aspects, and they wrote long reports. And you know what they found? It's going to work in Switzerland. So, Iceland is a little bit more bold than the Swiss. Please don't take 5 years to make it work. It does work in Norway. It does work in Sweden and Finland and Britain and Netherlands. And, Switzerland even it works. So you can do it too. So I hope that personal assistance schemes, inclusive education. I don't know enough about your transport and buildings provision. So far, I've been fine, but I've not been to many places. I'm not sure if you can make glaciers accessible, but maybe one day they will be.
Thank you. Any more questions?
I mean, you can get in touch with the WHO and ask questions that way, and yeah.
There's one question here.
I would start with thanking you for this really uplifting and interesting lecture of yours. I would like to hear your ideas on, well, we're always talking about that we have to fix accessibility, but we have to also change the views. And I'm thinking, do you have any ways for us that we can use to change the views on the issue on disabled people to make the views more positive? Have you any ideas for us?
I think that you're absolutely right. Changing attitudes to disability is really important. It's no use having an accessible bus if the bus driver is not willing to get out and use the ramp because they don't care. So we need not just accessible buildings, but accessible people. I think that this is slow. I think it starts in school with children understanding disability as part of the diversity of life and understanding that disabled people can do things and are not pathetic and weak. I think it goes through the media, having disabled people on the television, making films, talking about their lives, not as freaks, not as curiosities, not as tragedies, just as ordinary citizens. I think that we've talked about education of professionals. I think some issues are harder to challenge than others. For example, people have a lot of prejudice against people with mental health problems. Mm-hmm. But there have been these campaigns. Like in New Zealand, there was a campaign called Like Minds, Like Mine, which basically talked about how mental health were common problems. Many people experienced them. People were not violent, they were not dangerous, they were not tragic, they were not alien. They were like you and me. And this campaign really changed people's awareness and understanding of mental illness for the better. And you know, in Norway, the Prime Minister of Norway had a depression and he left work for 3 or 4 months. And he was very honest. He said, I can't cope. I need some time out. And I think this is the first time in the history of the world that a leader of a major country has acknowledged that they have a mental health problem. And we met him. He came to Geneva. He was a very unassuming, good man, I think. I don't know about his politics, but he came across as very honest and open. He took time out, and he came back, and he completed his political work. So I think that we need leaders who are able to be role models. And I know that Icelandic society has had a women president. You've had lesbian president. You've had president from different walks of life. And as we discussed earlier today, that inspires people. It inspires women. It inspires lesbian women. I'd like you to have a disabled president. So so maybe you could, knock your president over one day. And you see there, we got a disabled president. Actually, that was a joke. That was a joke. The World Health Organization is not recommending that you injure your president. Please. I will be sacked. My boss was saying you're advising the Icelanders to injure their president. I'm not. But I am hoping that one day that you do have a president with disability. Because we need our leaders to represent us and to reflect us. I write a blog which is called Our Statues Touch the Skies. It's disabledlives.blogspot.com. And I put in that all of the disabled people who are famous from history. And you probably know Winston Churchill had depression. He was a disabled person. Roosevelt, who's probably the greatest American president ever, was a polio survivor. He was in a wheelchair. Nobody saw him pictured in a wheelchair. Now we need a president in a wheelchair who goes, yeah, I'm in a wheelchair, it's fine. We actually have the finance minister of Germany who's in a wheelchair, Wolfgang Schäuble. He's a wheelchair user. I was watching the television one day and I'd forgotten. I don't watch television very often. And it was the global financial crisis, which I think you know something about. All of the politicians were coming into the room and there was a guy in a wheelchair. I thought, oh, that's great. Who's the guy in a wheelchair? And then I realized, oh, it's the finance minister of Germany. He's the problem, not the solution. But it was great that he was there. Nobody commented on it. It was just, yep, he's a wheelchair user. That's what we want. People in positions, a deaf person in a leadership position, a blind person in a leadership position. And we have had that before. But when we have that, we realize that disabled people are not useless. They can contribute.